I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a Muslim doctor relocates to rural Minnesota, hoping to dent a doctor shortage. The first few years introduced him to grateful patients, friendly neighbors, and amicable colleagues. But the election of Donald Trump in 2016 changed things. Many of the neighbors who often drop by the doctor's house for dinner voted for Trump, who at one point campaigned around the idea of a Muslim registry. To Dr. Ayaz Virji, it felt like betrayal. He considered leaving rural Minnesota behind, but a pastor's request that he help debunk myths surrounding Islam by leading community conversations anchored him in place. We'll talk with him about his practice, his relationship with the town, and his faith. Our conversation starts after a short break. Of carrying out what's known as turnstile medicine, Dr. Ayaz Virji decided to move his wife and young kids from a big East Coast city to the decidedly unfamiliar community of Dawson, Minnesota. His hope was settling in a small, rural community would do two things: fill a void in an area short on doctors and allow him to practice medicine in a deeper way, really get to know his patients and implement change. And it worked. His first few years in Dawson were warm and fulfilling. His practice was thriving and his family was happy. Then came the 2016 presidential election, and things changed. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Dr. Virji felt betrayed by the people he lived and worked alongside, the people who helped elect Donald Trump. And he saw racism and Islamophobia creep into his life in a way that didn't seem possible before the election. He thought very seriously about leaving, but after teaming up with a local pastor, decided to stay. Dr. Ayaz Virji's book is called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. And he joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio to talk about it. Dr. Virji, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit more about what it was like to practice medicine before you moved to Dawson. What exactly is turnstile medicine, and why did you want to make a change?
Sure. So we're seeing kind of a rise of a corporatocracy type medicine throughout the country, where a lot of times primary care doctors are feeling more and more that it's about volume and less quality of care that we're giving to people. And, you know, there are a lot of doctors out there and patients, of course, who are frustrated with that. And so I was practicing in, you know, a large group practice in southeastern Pennsylvania prior to moving to Dawson. And one of my reasons for moving was to do two things. First is to help fill the void of healthcare in rural America, because we really have a shortage of doctors. We have about 20% of the population and only about 9% of the physicians. And I'd read about kind of critical access hospitals closing, people not getting the care that they need. And for me, medicine has always been more than just a career. I've been doing work in free clinics most of my career for 15 years. And it also gives me the opportunity to spend more time with my patients, to be the doctor that they see in the hospital if they get hospitalized, the same doctor in the ER if they end up there, in the clinic or in the nursing home.
So when you went to visit Dawson, what did you like about it?
People were amazingly gracious and friendly. Now, Dawson was totally new for us. We didn't have any family in town. It was a place that we looked at, my wife and I, and said, you know, this could really benefit from having a physician. And we had gone through Islamophobia after 9/11, and we knew what it felt like. So when we came to interview, I told my wife, listen, the smallest, if somebody even looks this wrong, we're not going to move here, because we don't want that I don't want that for the family. I don't want to go through that again. And it was the exact opposite. And people were so kind, and they still are. They're wonderful people. And gracious people would come and introduce themselves to us on the streets. Almost like a kind of picture perfect type town. And even in the school, the principal and the teachers went out of their way to meet us and to welcome us to the community.
Can you explain the phenomenon of Minnesota nice?
So Minnesota nice is a stereotype of Minnesotans, and it depends upon who you talk to on whether that has a positive or a negative connotation. And to me, I still feel that people are very nice here overall, and others can look a little deeper into Minnesota nice and feel as that represents more of a not willing to talk about our differences, just keep things surface, keep things moving. So I suppose it depends upon who you talk to.
So you decided to make the move to Dawson. Tell me about your responsibilities there. You weren't just a doctor. You were running a lot.
Yeah. So, I've been practicing for about 17 years, and I've developed a lot of leadership skills, and I'm kind of the guy who goes and fixes things, you know, practices, or if a hospital is struggling, then go in and turn it around. So I came in as the chief of staff and the medical director of the clinic. And, you know, the hospital was struggling initially, and now since then, we are doing phenomenal. We're way in the black. We've developed 6 new service lines for the community, in addition to have recruited several new doctors. And, that coupled with kind of culture change for kind of the hospital system in general is what I'd aimed to do.
So what was life like for you and your family members when you first moved there? I know your wife opened a business. How did the kids adjust? What was kind of the early entry to Dawson like for your family?
Yeah, so the first 3 months was tough because it was just, we lived out of a hotel, like a one-bedroom hotel, and there wasn't a hotel in Dawson, so we had to go to Canby, which is a town nearby. So it was, of course, as it is for any move, stressful, but we didn't have any issues with our neighbors or people. I mean, it was your characteristic kind of rural type town where everybody knows one another. People bring over like baked goods to your door to welcome you. And, you know, when you go to the grocery store, you end up, you know, just talking to people for like half an hour. And, you know, when we moved, like I had an open door policy. Friends would just kind of come in and walk in. And I never locked my door. We do now, but we never did prior.
So are there any other Muslim families in Dawson?
Just us.
Just you guys. So let's fast forward a bit to election night in 2016. You and your wife kind of settled in to watch the returns with an air and excitement. You thought you were going to be seeing Hillary Clinton elected president of the United States.
Right. So to me, I was just expecting that to happen. I mean, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican, but she said things like America is great because America is good. She said things like stronger together. And, you know, I can get behind anybody who builds a platform like that. The other guy said stuff like, I'll, you know, punch the guy in the face. I'll pay your legal fees. And he said, Islam hates us and we need a registry. And he made fun of a disabled report. So for me, it was just commonsensical. It was like, nobody's going to vote for this guy. And my neighbors, who I just love and respected for being so kind and gracious, I was like, there's no way people are going to vote for that. And then, of course, when it came and it happened, myself, like I think a lot of Americans, I mean, your heart just sinks and you're like, what just happened? How could this possibly happen? And to me, it wasn't a politics thing. It wasn't like Democrat, Republican. It was about morality. Where was the floor? Is this a new floor of morality that we have in America? Do we not care about that kind of stuff? And for us particularly, it was a big deal because of the vicious stuff he said about Islam. And then, you know, within 2 weeks of the election, I mean, hate crimes, we had about, I think, a sweep of 800 hate crimes that just swept across the country. 3 mosques were burned down. That wasn't a coincidence. And we were in shock like many people.
How did your county vote?
65% voted for Donald Trump.
But did that, I mean, is surprise the right word? I mean, were you just completely blown away by that? I mean, you said you just assumed it was going to be a landslide for Hillary. When you found out the place you lived was a majority Trump county, a significant one, I mean, how did you react to that?
So shock and betrayal. Like, I felt like, you know, this is the guy who wants me and my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter, to be on a registry. And he says Islam hates us and that, you know, he has people like Michael Flynn, who is a board member of ACT, who says that, you know, the only good Muslim is a dead Muslim. And, you know, these things were visceral.
And how did you process this? I mean, I read every word of your book, and it was not an easy time for you. The morning after the election, I mean, you kind of started making plans to live your life differently.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is part of the journey, which is also educational for me because I'm also growing in the process of this whole thing. But I came out really angry, and I came out doing the things that I was condemning. I was condemning people for stereotyping Muslims, and here I am stereotyping everybody and saying, hey, listen, you guys are all just racist. And, you know, if you could, you would take the brownness out of me, the Muslim part of me, and put that on a registry and just keep the MD, just keep the doctor, because, you know, we need doctors so bad in this county and in this region. So I said some vicious things, which I regret, and we're not right. But that's how I felt. That's the anger that lasted at least a couple days, at least a couple days.
And you actually called your real estate agent, right, and said, let's put this house on the market. We're out of here.
Yeah, I called immediately, and she didn't respond, as we mentioned in the book, and then until much later, but it's probably good that she didn't.
Do you think that was a calculated move?
I do. I do.
So once kind of you made the decision to stay, was it your family? Is that why you decided initially that, okay, we're going to stay in Dawson, I'm going to settle down, and I'm going to get past this, and we're going to still be here? Was it because of your wife and kids?
So it was a large multifactorial decision. So I had sent my CVs out to a lot of places and I got a bunch of offers. And then every time I got an offer, it was, I don't know if I want to do this. I've got work to do and I like the place and I like people here. And we have family overseas, which ultimately was part of our decision. And we just felt like we wanted to continue doing not just the work that Mossart was doing in her salon and I was doing in the hospital, but also the lectures and hoping to educate people.
And yeah, I definitely want to talk about the lectures. Do you want to tell me about when you were approached to actually have a very public conversation about your faith?
Yeah, so I was angry and I had no interest in talking to people. I mean, my religion is very private to me. I don't care what people identify themselves as. I'm very interested in the actions and righteousness of people, and it doesn't matter what religion or ethnic background or nationality or what have you. So it's just a very private thing for me. Most people, I guess, didn't even know I was Muslim. But I was angry, and Pastor Mandy, who was a local intern pastor, she noted that. She saw that, and she also heard a lot of vitriol that was pointed toward us, the Virgi shouldn't be allowed to celebrate Christmas because they don't worship Jesus. And it's like, we've been doing that our whole life. We've been having a Christmas tree. Where did this come from? And then Pastor Mandy would give the sermons during Lent on Wednesdays. And we would babysit her daughter, Miriam, who was 9 months old. And people were telling her, you shouldn't keep them with the Virgis because they're going to try to convert her to Islam. And I'm like, a nine-month-old? If a nine-month-old can understand God and the cosmos, I would be learning from them, not vice versa. But this stuff was coming out. And she said, listen, let's do something. Let's do something positive here. There's a lot of negativity. Let's go out and start teaching.
And that was not an easy decision for you to make, right? I mean, if it had just been you, you probably wouldn't have said, yeah, let's just do this. But was it like a calling, kind of like the way medicine is?
I suppose. I mean, my original answer was like, no, and I don't want to do this. It's, I just want to go. And then after I thought about it, and of course, we all make kind of instinctive things by emotion. We say things that we regret and do things. So as the emotion calms down, it made me feel, after I thought about it, I said, this is the right thing to do. And it's the same reason I came to Dawson in the first place. It was, if not me, then who's going to do it? I can sit there and complain about the iniquity in medicine and about how there's problems, or I can do something about it. And I've worked in free clinics my entire career. When I was at Georgetown as a med student, I helped co-found the Community Medical Clinic in Herndon, Virginia. When I was at Duke, I worked at the Urban Ministries Free Clinic and the Red Crescent Free Clinic when I was in Florida. So it was always something that I needed to do as far as medicine. And then this came up as, I might be uniquely qualified to do this because I've studied comparative religion, for like 20 years on my own. And now this has come up and I have an invitation to go out and try to right some misconceptions, and I should do it. And my wife and I, we talked about it a lot and came up with the decision that we would do it.
And I'm going to save more on that until we come back from our break. But I do want to make the point that you said from the very beginning when you moved to Dawson that you weren't just there to work. I mean, you really, truly kind of immersed yourself in the community, and so did your entire family.
For sure.
And why was that so important to you, to really be a part of it?
Well, the idea of coming there was to fill gaps, to fill voids. And, critical access hospitals are closing. We don't want that to happen. We didn't want that to happen to Johnson Memorial. And we love the people, we love the community, and we were going to give it 110%.
My guest this hour is Dr. Ayaz Virgi. His book is called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in today for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Ayaz Virji. His book is called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. So before we went to the break, we talked a little bit about these big talks that you had planned at kind of the behest of Pastor Mandy Franz. Before we get to that, though, can you tell me a little bit about what life was like after the election for you and your family in Dawson? Was there a marked change for your experience there?
Yeah, so things really did change for us. And, you know, I'd mentioned some of the things that people were saying about us. And, you know, I'd start hearing stuff that I'd never heard before from my own patients. And this would be from friends in town that we would hear. Some people would have asked if I was even a citizen. They would ask one of my friends, hey, is he even a citizen of the country? Or, you know, why does Dr. Virji force his wife to cover her hair? And it's like, you don't even know my wife. You knew her. Nobody tells her what to do. You know, lastly me. And, you know, this kind of stuff was just becoming more normative. And then, you know, there was a swastika that was carved outside of my house. Now, there is some debate still whether or not that was there before or after. I'd never seen it before. But then we also had a swastika that was spray painted on the tennis courts of our local school. Now, that was all after the election. Now, this can't be a coincidence.
And your children had to endure some pretty rough comments from schoolmates as well.
Yeah, so my one son, he had a child come up to him and say, yeah, you know, your mother's a part-time suicide bomber because she wears hijab. Now, the child he's a good kid, and there's, you know, I know him, and I know he's good. It's just these kind of things, they hurt. They take a stab at you, and I don't know if people know that.
And as you said earlier, you'd encountered, you know, racism, Islamophobia before. One story in particular that just broke my heart that I think you should share if you're willing is what happened to your wife when she was driving your two then very young children in Florida on a highway.
Yeah, so that's one that, I mean, we still remember that, and she still remembers that. So she was, as a recently new doctor and practicing in Clearwater, Florida, and she was, had two children, two young kids at the time, and she was just, you know, new mom driving over to come see me in the afternoon for kind of just surprised me. And then somebody in a car over her notices that she's wearing hijab, and he just takes out a baseball bat or a lead pipe or something, starts brandishing it towards her. And she's just saying, get out of here. And you know, all these vulgarities, you know, go back to your home, go back to your country, if that doesn't sound familiar. But she was just devastated. And it was like, you know, she's crying and she's got, all she can think about is the two kids, Imran and Faisal, in the back, and like, oh my God, what if something happens? And then, you know, fate has it where she turns off, and then they turn off to another side, to I guess exit the interstate. She's really trembling, and then she meets me at the office, and she tells me about what happened, and I feel tremendous guilt, like, you know, I should have been there. You know, what if something happened to her? God, I would never forgive myself.
And she didn't even wear her hijab for a bit after that, right?
Yeah, she took it off, and I was totally for it. You know, I don't want that to happen to her. You know, it's funny because you can wear, if you're a woman, you can wear a scarf over your head if it's cold outside, or if you're a nun, or if you're a Mennonite. But if you're a Muslim, it's, you know, it's for some reason not acceptable.
And that was much closer to, you know, just much closer to 9/11, and I think you probably thought when you got to Dawson that you weren't in the same era, but can you kind of describe the feeling that you all encountered when you noticed things start to change post-2016 election?
Yeah, it's kind of like deja vu, stuff that you would never have, you thought it was done, like it was past, and we had come so far into not experiencing anything like that, and, you know, those types of comments, like, you know, go back where you came from, you know, that, I mean, I lived with that when I was young. That was normal. Like, I would have, you know, kids in school say, yeah, go back to Mexico. I'm like, well, you know, I'm not Mexican. Or did you want me to have a good vacation? I'm actually from a different continent. But that was normal. But that was just, it was so far away. And the stuff that we'd experienced post 9/11 left its scars, but never more than that. And then all of a sudden, you have this universe opening where people that you know and care about are saying things to you or about you that are just, you're in shock. Like when I first announced that I was going to do the talks, and it was done through Grace Lutheran Church, people protested. They said a Muslim should not be allowed to speak publicly. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Where did this come from? And you guys know me. I'm the town doctor. I'm probably your doctor, you know, but the protests were so bad they came to the school board, and the school board had to convene a number of times, and they wanted to actually charge us for the additional time they had to spend talking about whether or not we were even allowed to have a talk. This is after hours in the auditorium, which we rented, which is the only place in Dawson large enough to hold a crowd of 400. But this is all real. This all happened.
And so tell me how the talks were, how you structured them, how you decided that they were going to work. As you said, it's not like you got pushback as far as, no, you're not allowed to do this, but they made it difficult and charged you extra and you had to get your own AV equipment, I believe. So what was the idea? And I love that your wife kind of gave you these 3 points that you were to stick to.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you talk to Masard, I can be a little long-winded. And we decided we were going to do the talks, and then Grace Lutheran put the advertisements out. And then a lot of people complained because you couldn't advertise a Muslim speaker. You were allowed to advertise a Grace Lutheran Church event. So we had to pull those advertisements down and then rebrand it as, you know, Grace Lutheran Church event featuring Dr. Ayaz Virji. So we did that. And then at the last minute, the AV got pulled. You know, you're not allowed to stream this because we had so many complaints. And I'm like, you know, you haven't even heard me speak yet. What are you complaining about? Did I say something wrong? I'm just going to go and start a conversation. And you guys know who I am. You know, it's not like I'm just visiting from another town or something. But that all happened. And it was interesting. After the first talk, we got a lot of support after that. A lot of people came up to me and said, you know, you really opened my eyes and, you know, thank you for doing this. And for me, it was just, this is a one and done thing. I didn't want to do it again. But then all of a sudden, the invitations were coming. They just kept coming from different towns and from universities. And then Mandy and I decided, maybe we should accept some of these and start kind of pushing the message out.
So what were those 3 points that your wife really wanted you to hone in on during that first talk in Dawson?
Yeah. So there were 3 things, woman, terrorism, and Sharia. That's what everybody wants to hear. So originally when I started the talk, and yeah, that was in the book, I wrote out this kind of philosophical talk talking about, you know, theosophy and, you know, origins of Islam and history and this and that. And then when I gave the kind of practice talk before Mossart and Pastor Mandy, their jaws hit the floor and said, you cannot give that talk. You will have lost everybody. These are the 3 things you need to talk about, and that's it. And so I went upstairs. This was the night before, because the talk took me about 20 hours to put together. So I went upstairs, and for about 6 hours straight on like a legal notepad, I just redrafted the entire thing, focusing on those points.
And it's really interesting that you picked those 3 because it is kind of the rhetoric that you hear about Muslim families always seems to go back to one of those 3. What do you think the big fear about conversion, where do you think that comes from? Because from what I understand, Islam isn't particularly big on like witnessing and trying to convert people from other religions.
Yeah, I don't know. It's fear. It's what people have been told, because in Islam, it says very clearly there should be no compulsion in religion. And it says in the Quran very clearly, we created you in many nations and tribes so that you may know one another. And the best of you is the most righteous, the one who does the best, you know, for others. Now, of course, you've got radical groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and that just want to go out and convert. But you've got radical groups in every religion, in every, you know, ethnicity. But I just think that the message has been out there of fear. And fear takes good people in even rural communities, and then turns it into anger, and anger into hatred, and hatred into suffering. Yoda from Star Wars had it right. That's what has, at least I've been seeing, has been happening.
You played kind of an interesting little game during your talk where you wanted people to identify a passage as either being from the Quran or from the Bible. How did that go over?
No, it was great. And this came from people. Some people had criticized me saying, you don't know your own religion. And I'm like, well, interesting. Should you teach? Who should teach me? Like, who knows my religion then? And that's where the idea came up, because people were making the point, no, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, that's the true Islam. And it's like, no, that's like saying the KKK and Jonestown is the true Christianity. That's just not true. So, you know, I would just read verses from the Quran or Bible. And then I would ask people, I would in the audience, say, okay, which book is it? And very simple. So one verse was from Corinthians, which said, you know, on account of the angels, a wife should cover her hair to show that she is under the submission of her husband. And that's from Corinthians. That's from the Bible. So it was interesting and I think eye-opening for people to hear that it's very easy for anyone to take a verse here or there out of context and to demonize a whole group of people. It's easy for me to do that, just like it's easy for other people to do that to Islam or to any religion. But if we do that to each other, what kind of world are we creating?
And that first talk in Dawson, did you, as you were giving it, it was hard to look out of the audience because there were lights and there were 400 faces, but could you kind of sense that something was happening, that you were connecting in some way and that they were with you?
For sure. I would say maybe 10, 15 minutes in, people were really engaged. I mean, I had a standing ovation at the end, which was shocking. I was just worried about, you know, people not throwing stuff at me. But it was wonderful. And the questions were good. They were sincere. There were some that were, you know, hey, why aren't you converting, kind of this type of thing, like trying to convert me. Mm-hmm. But I think they were sincere. And, you know, after the talk, many people thanked me for doing it. And there was definitely a positive response. Now, there was a negative response, too. There was, you know, a group in Dawson who then invited a hate speaker to come in to counter our message. And he did his rounds in the local community. And the name of his talk was not Love Thy Neighbor. It was The Trojan Horse of Interfaith Dialogue. And in his talk, he says, you shouldn't even be friends with Muslims. They're here to, like, subterfuge the Constitution, and you need to be scared and this and that. But so you do see, you know, the whole gamut of responses.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. There was a really touching moment in the book where you talk about your daughter's choice to wear a headscarf, kind of right in the middle of a whole lot going on. Can you tell us what she chose to do and why?
Yeah, so that was the day that she chose to wear it at school. And I think she did it because she wants to be like mommy. And I talked to her about it, and I said, listen, you don't have to do this. And she's like, it's okay. I want to do it. I know I don't have to, but I want to do it. And for her, it was, you know, an identity thing, like no different than like a Christian wearing a cross around her neck. And so it was touching to see her do that. And, you know, I think it was a very positive thing. And I don't know whether, you know, when she grows up, where she'll wear hijab or not. I really don't care. I want her to be a good person, as I want for all my kids.
And it's interesting you mentioned that kind of counter speaker, I guess, for lack of a better word, because just because you had this talk go over well in Dawson, it wasn't like you had made some sort of like universal understanding across the country. You had talks not go nearly as well after that.
Yeah. It was nothing like that. So, you know, along with the support, the hate mail came in, the death threats came in. And, you know, at one of the talks, one guy stepped up and called me the Antichrist and said, yeah, it doesn't matter what you do, you're the Antichrist. And so we got all of that. And, you know, and even I would say the guy who stood up and called me the Antichrist, even him, I would say, you know, he's probably just very scared and that, you know, of Muslims. And he told me, he said, you know, it doesn't matter that you came here to, you know, help out or that you worked in free clinics, you know, you don't believe this, therefore, you're this. And I was like, well, you know what, if I thought that from, I just never would have come. And then if that's how we choose to believe in society, then how do we solve problems? And I remember telling him, okay, well, if it's just if what you do has nothing to has no relevance to who you are as a person, so your actions don't matter, it's just what you say you believe, then Hitler, who killed, you know, 6 million Jews in order to purify the Aryan race for God, because it said in, you know, on the belt buckles of Nazis that God is with us, is in, you know, in heaven enjoying salvation with God versus Gandhi, who is, you know, one of the most peaceful people of the 20th century. And he's the guy who said, I am all religions, but no religion. He must be burning in hell right now. So therefore, you have more in common with Hitler than you do me. And when I told him that, he was aghast. Like, how dare you say that? And I said, you know, I didn't say that. I just took your logic to the natural conclusion. And that's basically what you're saying.
Do you find that when people question you or try to pin your faith down in a way you don't agree with, do you have to be really armed with evidence to try to even get them to listen to you? Do you have to have like the text down and the examples and the analogies ready? Or do people just hear what they want to hear? Does that help? Or, I mean, how does that go down when someone's just decided that you're wrong and they're going to tell you?
Yeah. So the standards for somebody like me coming out and talking about a message like this is way high. So yes, I have to know where I'm coming from, what I'm quoting. I provide the quotes. In fact, I provide the references even to a lot of the talks prior so that people know exactly where to get the information when I talk about, whether it's in the Bible, whether it's in the Quran, or whether it's from, you know, this U.S. State Department or the Department of Justice or what have you, because there's so much nonsense out there. Versus when people try to condemn me or condemn Islam, they just read a quotation out of some no-name author somewhere who says something about Islam and says, well, somebody who is a jerk said this about your religion, therefore it must be true. Now, if I were to do that to you, you know, to Christianity, would you accept that? You know, L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, said that Jesus was a pedophile because of that verse in Mark where this young steward of his who was half naked had his clothes pulled away and he ran away naked. Now, I would never go to a Christian and say, gosh, this, you know, person who is not a Christian, doesn't believe what you do, said this about your religion, therefore it must be true. That's terrible. That's not the way that we have discourse.
So basically, two completely different bars, a very, very high bar for you and then no bar at all for people who are against you?
Pretty much, yeah. Many times, not everybody.
My guest this hour is Dr. Ayaz Virji. His book is called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. We'll be back after a short break. Dallas, you're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Dr. Ayaz Virji. His book is called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. So that first Love Thy Neighbor talk, as you said, felt like a success. You felt like the crowd was with you. You did a really interesting little slideshow at the end of that talk that kind of caught my attention because you managed to mix some really heartbreaking photos of, you know, examples of hate crimes in with some really funny down-to-earth shots of you and your family around the house.
Yeah, that felt like a good way to kind of conclude it. So we just, took pictures of the family and what we do. I took a picture of, you know, my son at one of his drama performances. And I was like, hey, look, brown people doing brown people stuff. And my cats, you know, it's like, we got like three cats. I was like, hey, look, they're not making bombs or anything like that. They're just being cats. They're like tracking litter. And we got the same problems as everybody else. And then I just coupled that with pictures of, you know, that happened in Orlando. And actually things that happened to even my brother, who he got a fax at his work office in Orlando saying, you know, F you, Trump is in now, we're going to get, you know, rid of you effing Muslim pigs. And, you know, and then a friend of ours had somebody defame a tombstone of a family, basically put Trump Prince stickers all over it, you know, just to send a signal, hey, get out of here. There's a new sheriff in town. So it's kind of sad.
Do you think that really connected with people? We all, you know, see articles about things like this or internet slideshows about examples. But the fact that you said someone sent this to my brother, do you think that got through to people in a way that maybe they hadn't considered before?
Well, it sure got through to me when that happened. That was terrible. But I hope so. I think whenever you have a personal connection and you can humanize an event or humanize what somebody else says, then it does, you know, go deeper into somebody's kind of cerebral cortex and processing it. So I hope so.
Let's take an email question now. We got one from Len, and her question is, or his, pardon me for not knowing, how do we get more people to love one another, to love your neighbor? I believe we need to start with the children to encourage and teach them how to respect and love one another. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that's great. I appreciate the question. And I think that when you look at any like major world religion or philosophy, whether it be, you know, Islam or Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism, even atheist humanism, the principal core of those beliefs are the same. It's virtue, it's love, it's kindness, it's inclusion, generosity, charity. They're all teaching the same thing. And it's funny because in studying comparative religion, the more I would take a deeper dive into another faith, whenever I would take a deeper dive into Buddhism or Christianity, the deeper I went, the more I saw myself. I saw my own values. So I think as we teach people that, that there's so much more that binds us together and that we're similar versus that separate us, and that our differences should be celebrated. And also that unfortunately, in the media, there's so much negativity that's constantly broadcasting instead of the positivity, that it's easy for people over, you know, years and decades to see a certain group represented in a certain way and just kind of have that as, you know, the stereotyped, you know, person. And it takes a long time to undo that, but it can be done.
So you hinted this earlier. I mean, this is not a movie. This really happened. So it's not like you gave your talk and the standing ovation happened and then everything was fine. How did things in town change for you and your family after that first love thy neighbor conversation in Dawson, for, you know, for the good or for the bad? What's different now?
Yeah, so definitely different directions. So many people did come to me. I mean, even during, you know, office visits, say thank you, would give me a hug and saying, you know, you opened my eyes. You really taught me something. And that's really what we wanted to do. I'd say, you know, half the people were supportive anyway, and that's great, but we weren't doing it for people who were already open-minded. A certain percentage was just never going to have it. And then that group, you know, definitely saw changes in, you know, people coming over. I definitely saw changes in, you know, the way we were regarded in different places. And, you know, like that one time when my wife and I were sitting in Wanda's and talk about this in the book, and then one of the locals came down and said, hey, you know, all Muslims should be on a registry. It's like, no, they shouldn't. And, you know, I just want to eat lunch. Just leave me alone. So there is that dichotomy, but I think the good is far more than the fearful.
How do you think, I mean, these talks, like you said, it wasn't a one and done. It wasn't even just we do a couple in the region and go forward. This is something that is a part of you and your family. Can you kind of describe how the Love Thy Neighbor, the original talk, has kind of influenced you going forward?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I definitely learned a lot myself, because I also, when it happened, I stereotyped everybody else and I said, hey, listen, you guys are just all racist and this, and that was wrong. So it was an inflection point for myself. And I was like, wait, you know, I'm just becoming the same thing that I'm condemning. And then later it was the Islamophobia. But then after the first set of talks and after the Washington Post piece, I got over 700 letters in the mail and emails thanking me for this. People from the Muslim community, from the Jewish community, from, you know, the evangelical community, from the LGBTQ community, people who were saying they didn't recognize their country anymore. And they were telling me to keep doing this. I got a letter from like a former colonel in the army saying, you've done more for the Constitution in your talks than I've done my entire military service. Now, that's just heartfelt. That's just amazingly great. So it turned more into not Islamophobia type thing, but a message of inclusion. And then the Islamophobia part was almost like a case study. And that's kind of how it morphed.
How do your children feel about these conversations? Have they been fueled or motivated? Were they scared? Were they proud? Because it's hard to predict exactly how something like this is going to affect our children.
They think I talk too much.
So pretty traditional then.
Yeah, they're kids. And Imran, my middle son, he's very quiet. Definitely things affect him. and he doesn't always talk about it. So I always try to open the dialogue with him. My eldest son, Faisal, he has autism. He has high-functioning autism. And, you know, he was the one who came in saying, hey, can't we just pretend we're not Muslim so we can stay in Dawson? And that was a poignant moment for us too, because I didn't even have an answer. I don't even know what to say to that. But we've tried to have discussions as a family. And then when you know, hate mail came in and we started locking our doors and started, you know, I had to talk to them and say, hey, listen, you guys just need to be more cautious and things of that sort. So that's kind of how it's been for us.
And that was the next kind of question I was going to ask you. You talk about how you have to lock your doors and you do get, you know, negative and nasty responses to things you're trying to communicate. Does that get easier over time, hearing that, getting pushed back, or hearing, you know, an echo chamber of, you know, what you perceive as ignorance? Or does it get harder? Do you get more and more weary the more hate that you hear?
You know, the more I was talking, the more people I would meet who were trying to do the same thing of bringing people together, like Bishop Eaton from the ELCA. And I would find out from people like that, people like chaplains at Georgetown who were trying to do the same things, how much death threats and how much hate that they experienced. So it was almost like I felt like we should form a club, you know, we should do this together. So in that sense, it got easier because there's more people who are trying to do the good thing. And so it's never fun getting, you know, something threatening or nasty. I mean, but it does when you know that there are more people who are trying to do the right thing and they're with you, then it gives you strength.
Let's take a quick call now. We're going to hear from Walter in Dallas. Go ahead with your question, Walter. Walter?
I appreciate the doctor and his tremendous courage. I feel deeply for his sorrow in being mistreated by so many people. But I wanted to ask him what he thought about the possibility that we should have some form of continuing education on comparative religions. Now, this is one of the few times in history when we have an amalgam of different cultures merging together so easily, and people are, you know, just persistently ignorant about the tenets of other religions. Certainly Islam is a loving and caring religion. Anyone who's ever read anything about it knows that to be the case. But should we make an effort? The Christian community, the Jewish community, the other communities, make a serious effort to make sure that we all understand what the tenets are of the religions.
Walter, thank you for your question. You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. What do you think, Dr. Virji? What comparative religions, would that help people with perspective?
Wow, I thought that was a great comment. You know, I think that in the public school system, world history, world religions are not emphasized enough. And I think that when you go and discuss what each religion, worldview has to offer to the world, whether it be Hinduism or Islam or Christianity or Buddhism or Taoism, you actually find so much more similarity. And in this modern day world where we've got the world becoming smaller with the internet and international travel, it probably would behoove us to do something along those lines. That would be a fantastic goal.
So when you first moved to Dawson, you moved there really with kind of the selfless goal of, I want to be a better doctor, I want to help a community that has a major shortage, and I'm not just going to do it as a, you know, 9-to-5 doctor, I'm going to kind of do some comprehensive overhaul of rural healthcare in my community. So that really was like a true calling for you. How much has your calling changed now that you started giving these talks? Are you still in the community primarily to be a doctor, or do you feel like now there's other work to be done?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, I still enjoy being a physician, and I still always see that as my primary kind of intervention point. And, you know, I look forward to the day where I don't have to do any of these talks, and I can just kind of go back into obscurity, and nobody remembers me, and I can just go and do medicine. And that's how I see myself, and that's how I see or hope my future to be.
How many of these have you given now?
25.
25. Is there, aside from that initial talk in Dawson and the one that kind of right after where the counter hate speech was a part of that experience, is there one that's been particularly memorable for you? And if so, why?
That's a good question. I think, you know, it's different when we give the talk to a community population and an academic population, because the responses tend to be very, very different. And I would say that, I guess, going back to Georgetown and giving the talk in my first year lecture hall was just an amazing, amazing experience. I never thought I would do something like that. And then when we got such a crowd, I mean, there was standing room only of professors and medical students, and that we went over the time, but so many more people had questions that we actually had to go to a different room, and everybody followed, and then we talked for another hour or so. I don't think I'll ever forget that. I was just so honored by that.
And you have a story in the book where when you were either an intern or a medical resident, I don't remember, but someone basically decided they wanted you off their girlfriend's case because of the way that you looked. And that was a horrible experience for you. And you ended up kind of changing a little bit after that. Do you recognize that young doctor now when you think about everything that you've stood up and said in front of your community and in front of people that have challenged you? Does that feel far away as someone who was intimidated by someone who was racist?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I've tried really hard not to remember that instance. And it's just, there was so much fear that I had. I was so scared with that guy. I mean, my foot was shaking. I was like, you know, but that wouldn't happen to me now. I mean, now if somebody did that to me, I'd say just, you know, whatever. I'll see you later. I'm going to call the police. But, that was, I do remember that moment. It definitely had an effect on me for a while. But I think, you know, I definitely am a lot stronger than that scared, you know, Indian Muslim minority kid or young medical student. I think I'm more sure of myself. And I don't think I would worry or be as intimidated in a circumstance like that.
Why do you think on the other side of that experience you found so much strength and kind of were able to go forward so differently?
You know, I think having looked at, I mean, I'm really blessed to have a diverse background. I have a very international family. My dad traveled around a lot. I have one brother. I was born in Africa. One brother who was born in Italy. The other one was born in England. We grew up in the U.S., traveled to the Far East, went to lots of places. I had the privilege of going to a Christian school, a Lutheran school, for the first 10 years of my life. And I have really good memories of that. And I think that, coupled with studying comparative religion, gave me the benefit of being able to see so much more beautiful color in the world and help form me the way that I am now.
My guest this hour is Dr. Ayaz Virji. His book is called Love Thy Neighbor, A Muslim Doctor's Struggle for Home in Rural America. Dr. Virji, thank you so much for your time. What an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAthink. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.